Anything to lose. I have no secrets to hide. I could just be blunt and people could judge it however they judge it.
From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff. The first thing that needs to be done in any murder investigation is an examination of victimology. Before you can even begin to narrow down a suspect pool, first you have to identify a victim's risk factors. What type of person they were? What was their temperament? Were they involved in any activities that could put them into risky situations and perhaps cause them to be the target of violence? To be clear, we're not talking about victim blaming here. Victimology is not about suggesting that the victim of a violent crime somehow invited or asked for their own attack. It's about understanding where and how they may have come into contact with their attacker, so that we can find the offender and bring them to justice. For example, imagine a woman's nude body is found dumped on the side of the road somewhere. A thorough look at her victimology can be used to direct investigators to a suspect pool. Say she was a factory worker with no history of drug or alcohol use. She lived alone with her boyfriend and recently told a friend that she thought that she might be pregnant. She has no other identifiable risk factors and was last seen headed home from work. In that case, detectives should begin their investigation with the boyfriend. Now take that same discarded nude body on the side of the road, but this time the investigation reveals that the woman was single, lived alone with just her and her German Shepherd, and earned a living as a sex worker. Sex work is a legitimate risk factor. No one is judging or blaming the victim for making her living that way, but knowing that should lead detectives to start investigating men who hire sex workers in the area where she works. Or let's say the victim is a married school teacher and a victimology investigation reveals that she's having an affair, or that her husband is having an affair. The point is that you can see how the same body in the same situation yields wildly different investigative paths based on the victim's life and risk factors. That's victimology. It's not about blame or judgment. It's about understanding and identifying the risk factors that may have played a part in the victim being attacked. And more importantly, identify a clear path of investigation. In DeMario Lowe's case, sadly, his risk factors are very similar to many people living in the city of Benton Harbor. That was part of why last week we spent so much time trying to learn what it's like to live in that community. It can be a violent place. The community doesn't trust the police, and everyone is policing themselves with guns. And unfortunately, as we see in many inner cities throughout the country, what comes with poverty? Drugs. Drugs tend to serve as both a way to escape as well as a way to earn a living in situations like this. And it's not just black neighborhoods, don't be fooled by that misconception. It's the poor neighborhoods. I know some people right here where I live that suffer from addiction, and I've asked them where they get their drugs, and it's usually one of two places. The inner city type neighborhood, similar to Benton Harbor, populated mostly by people of color, or in the trailer parks, populated by mostly white people. There's no shame in living in either place, but the fact is that both of these areas of town, at least around here, are stricken by poverty. And it's really easy to score whatever you're looking for in either place from either race. So far, sadly, I can't tell you a lot about DeMario Lowe's life. I've been reaching out to every known relative I can find, and I have even asked some old students of mine from Benton Harbor for help locating DeMario's people. As of now, no one has responded. But know that we do plan to continue this work to find someone to share more about his life. Our work here is not just about getting justice for Jody Hill. Ultimately, we're seeking justice for DeMario Lowe's, and I refuse to let him turn into a footnote in his own story. What I do know about DeMario comes mostly from his obituary, and that's not much. He was born in Saginaw, Michigan on October 6th of 1978. so he was just 22 years old at the time he was killed. His parents were Johnny Williams and Willie Mae Lowes. He worked on and off part-time at several restaurants in town, and from the few people that I have spoken to that did know him, they all refer to him as Mario. He was a guy with a lot of friends and a big family. He had three sisters, LaWanda Morrow, Monique Lowes, and Leonie Lowes. At the time of his death, both Monique and Leonie were living in Saginaw. He also had a brother, Jeffrey Williams of Chicago, and two nieces, Denaja Evans of Benton Harbor, and Leonta Lowes, who lived in Saginaw. The obituary says that Mario had three aunts, six uncles, and, quote, a host of cousins. He also left behind a son, DeMario Jr. Most of what we know about Mario comes from parsing through the various police interview notes, trial testimonies. We have to read between the lines on a lot of occasions. No one was asking witnesses to tell us about Mario. Instead, what you notice from all these statements is that Mario had a lot of friends. One person that I spoke to about him told me that he was just a goofy, fun guy. Most everyone seemed to get along with him. But Mario did have some risk factors. Namely, that we see indications throughout the police interviews with friends that he was dealing drugs. From what I can tell, it doesn't seem like he was selling on a real high level, probably just selling dime bags here and there for a higher level dealer. But he was dealing, which means he was holding other people's property and money, and he was in regular contact with people who have reputations for using violence to enforce their business. So that's a known risk factor, and there could be others, but we also have a lot of unknowns. We don't know if Mario was robbed on the night that he was killed, and that's an important missing element to profile this scene. We have no reports that he was carrying a large sum of cash that night or a large amount of drugs, so we don't know if the lack of either of those things indicates a motive or if he just never had them to begin with. Now, the state was pushing the idea, of course, that Jody Hill murdered DeMario Lowes based on some vendetta, so they made clear to point out at trial that they did not believe that Mario was robbed. They say that because no jewelry was taken or a small bag of weed in his pocket. But again, that may be true, but also we don't know what else he may have had. We don't know what else may have been taken from him. And based on what I'm seeing in the reports, there really wasn't any effort to investigate a motive here. Jody's then-girlfriend was already being questioned about Jody's possible involvement less than 12 hours after the murder. This investigation is reminiscent of the West Memphis Police Department's investigation into Damien Echols. The detectives had blinders on immediately. They were so sure, immediately, that they knew who did it, that they didn't bother to investigate any other angles. In the West Memphis 3 investigation, the detectives failed to search the homes of the victims or even interview their parents. And in this case, it was assumed that Jody was responsible, so no one ever thought to investigate the possibility of robbery as a motive. Or for that matter, why Mario was at 784 Broadway that night to begin with. What you have is a man that was clearly targeted. Mario was shot several times outside of the building, and the attack continued to the inside as he tried to flee. Now, without knowing if anything was taken, we don't know if this was a personal cause homicide, someone killed Mario because they had a beef specifically with him, or if he was killed for drugs or money and it wasn't anything personal at all. Or the state's theory, he was killed to stop him from testifying in an upcoming trial for an incident that happened just a few days prior. On November 13th, just three nights before his murder, DeMario was the victim of an attempted armed robbery. That evening, DeMario had been cruising around town in his little red hatchback, which he commonly did. Mario was well-known and well-liked around Benton Harbor and was always riding around just hanging out, according to lots of people who were interviewed. Even just minutes before the robbery, he pulled up to a woman named Jessica Pratt and asked her to get in the car with him to drive around and smoke a blunt. She declined because she was on her way to go home to her son, and Mario began to drive off. But he didn't get but a few feet away when he was flagged down by two men. They were asking him for a ride. And it seemed like Mario was going to oblige them, but then as the two men approached the car, they both pulled out guns and flanked both sides. Jessica said that she was still right there. She'd only walked a short distance towards her house when she heard gunshots. She looked back to see Mario struggling with the men. He was out of the vehicle fighting with one of the would-be robbers on the driver's side, while the other man appeared to be getting into the passenger side. Now, by sheer happenstance, Officer Jeff Sturgill was sitting in the back of a church parking lot that he refers to as the Congo, eating his lunch. His shift began at 7 p.m., so 10 p.m. was evidently his lunch break. Now, Sturgill's backstory is kind of an interesting one. It doesn't really have anything to do with this case other than providing a glimpse into his credibility, but a year after the murder, it was discovered that back in 1998, he didn't think he could pass the physical agility test to complete the police academy, so he had his roommate run it for him. He was decommissioned as an officer once this was discovered in 2002. Again, nothing really to do with this case, but interesting nonetheless. Particularly because by the time Jody's trial came around, Sturgill was one of the witnesses who was suddenly able to identify them as one of the attempted armed robbers in this incident. So there he is, Sturgill. He's enjoying his meal behind the church, which is right next to where the incident occurred when he heard gunshots. He put his food down and pulled out onto Bellevue, where he saw the struggle at Mario's car. He parked his cruiser in front of Mario's hatchback, almost bumper to bumper. He observed two men fighting over a gun outside of the car near the hood, and another man on the passenger side. That person took off running, and then Officer Sturgill joined in on the struggle with the other two, and he was able to get the gun away from those two men. At which point, the other attacker fled into an open field nearby, following his accomplice. Sturgill stayed on the scene with DeMario, but another officer who he had radioed to and was patrolling nearby caught the man soon after and brought him back to the scene. That man was Leon Newcomb, who happened to be Jody's foster brother. Leon was booked into the county jail, and here's where Jody's assumed connection to Mario's murder comes in. There are several reports that we're going to get into later. We're going to dig into all of this in much more detail, piece by piece, as we move along. But those reports indicate that Leon had set someone that he was in the tank with out to threaten Mario, trying to stop him from testifying against Leon. The detectives investigating Mario's murder believed that Jody was also involved in the attempt to silence him, mostly because they suspected Jody as the second robber. In the 2 days between the robbery and the murder, DeMario had been showing off a sawed-off shotgun that he said that the second robber had left in his car when he fled. And this is kind of a strange part of the story. So during the robbery, Leon was wielding a .22 caliber pistol, a gun that went off during the struggle and grazed the palm of Mario's hand. The second attacker, the one who was on the passenger side of the car and fled and got away, had a sawed-off shotgun that was spray-painted gold, and he left it in the car when he ran away. Now, it's not strange that the person left the gun behind. There was a cop right there, and they obviously wouldn't want to be running away with a gun in hand. What's strange is that Sturgill didn't notice it. A big-ass gun, spray-painted gold, sitting in the passenger seat of the car, and neither he or any of the other cops saw it, or at least they didn't bother to collect it. So DeMario ended up just taking it home with him, and he was keeping it at home in his closet, and also had showed it off to a few people. But one thing that is important is that DeMario did not identify either of the people who attacked him on the 13th and did not indicate to anyone that he spoke to that he knew who either one of them were. So in reality, the fear that anybody would have had about DeMario identifying the second robber was moot. He didn't know who the second robber was, never did. On the night DeMario was killed, he was again cruising around town with a variety of friends. And I wish that I could give you a succinct account of his evening, but unfortunately, we have around a half dozen statements from different people who all say that they were with him that night, but none of those statements seem to align. In another episode, we're going to break them all down and try to come up with a working timeline. But what I want to focus on right now is Canvas Smith's statement, because I believe that she provides our most meaningful look into Mario's victimology. Canvas says that she was riding around with Mario that night, drinking with him. They were cruising around town. At some point, they picked up a man named Andre Williams. They hung out with a group of people partying for a while. At some point, they dropped Andre off at home. And then after that, Mario took Canvas back to her house. He wasn't done hanging out with her, but he dropped her off and said that he needed to go do something and that he would be back in a bit to continue hanging out with her. You're going to hear in the next segment that Mario was hanging out by himself listening to music when he was killed. Based on everything that we do know about Mario's victimology and about who he was, everyone seems to agree he was an extremely social guy. He had a lot of friends and spent most of his time in their company, but on the night that he was murdered, he took a break from those activities because he had something to do. He clearly intended to continue hanging out with Canvas that night, but whatever that thing was important enough for him to drop her off for a bit while he went to go take care of it. Then he was last seen just standing out by his car, alone, listening to music. Why would someone as social as Mario stop socializing in the middle of the night to go stand in a parking lot by himself? I think the answer is simple. Mario was meeting someone at 784 Broadway. And the person he was meeting is very likely the one who took his life. The story of the murder of DeMario Lowe's is one that, as is the case with many wrongful convictions, evolves over time. Witness statements tend to warp and change as detectives and prosecutors try to build their case. Pressure to give a statement that fits the investigator's theory rather than simply speaking the truth is the cornerstone of any false prosecution. Add a bit of reward money into the mix in an impoverished community, and you end up with a narrative that by trial doesn't even resemble the initial statements taken at the time of the murder. And that's exactly what happened in Jody's case, which leaves me with the dilemma of how to tell this story. And the best solution that I can come up with is to start from the beginning and dig into the details of each of the elements as we move along with the season, episode by episode. So that's what we're going to do here. The source material for today's episode is Detective Dan McGinnis, now Public Safety Director Dan McGinnis's initial report on the incident. Along with that, the reports from the first officer on the scene that night and a couple others. But these are all the initial reports from what Director McGinnis calls the original murder book. Now, the first thing that I noticed when I started reading through these reports is that no one seems to know when the murder actually occurred. You heard me say last week that one of the key documents that I've been searching for is the dispatch log. It seems like a simple request, but for whatever reason, it's absent from the case file, and the exact time of the incident is never revealed in any of these reports. If you look at them on our website, you'll see the time 12:40 a.m. referenced in most of them, but that time isn't exact. In fact, some of the narratives say around 12:40 a.m. The lack of specificity here is startling. I was a firefighter in Bering County at the time of this murder, so I have a full understanding of how to write reports just like this. The first thing that I would do after returning to the station after an incident is to call dispatch for the times. Their system records all of the radio transmissions and 911 calls with exact timestamps, down to the fraction of a second. But that doesn't seem to have been done here, nor is the dispatch log included in the file. The best guess we have at when the incident began comes from Officer Takamoto's report. He was the first arriving officer, and he wrote the following. Quote, Officer Dienick and I were on patrol northbound on Pipestone near Division. I then heard about 5 to 6 gunshots that sounded like they were possibly coming from the area of the 700 or 800 block of Ogden. I advised Benton Harbor Dispatch Sergeant London about this, searched the area, and found no signs of gunshots in the area. About a minute later, Sergeant London said that the Benton Harbor PD Dispatch received a phone call that the gunshots were possibly in the area of the 700 block of Pearl or Broadway. BHPD received a second phone call a few seconds later that the gunshots were in the lower level of 784 Broadway. Officer Dienick and I then went to 784 Broadway. End quote. So Takamoto and Dienick were alerted to the shots when they heard them. Takamoto then says that they drove over and searched the area of the 7 and 800 block of Ogden. I posted a map of the area on our website to give you the lay of the land. The blue arrows depict the path of the officers' travel, and the two red ovals represent the first area where they believe the shots came from and the second area that they headed to. So after hearing the shots, they searched a two-block area before dispatch ever received a 911 call about the shooting. That call did not come from someone in the apartment building where the murder occurred. The caller could only direct the police to the area where they thought the shots came from, the 700 block of either Pearl or Broadway, which run parallel to each other. Then finally, another call came in directing the officers to the actual crime scene address, 784 Broadway. The point being that a significant amount of time passed between the shots being fired and the 911 call from inside the apartment building. The lack of accurate reporting of the times here will prove to be a critical misstep. Jody Hill didn't even clock out of work that night until 12:05 a.m. So the window of time for them to have been involved in DeMario's murder was slim, to say the least, even if the murder did happen at 12:40. The first witness to be interviewed was the upstairs tenant, a woman named Victoria Miles. This is McGinnis's report regarding Victoria's interview in its entirety. Quote, "I spoke to Miss Miles at the scene upstairs in her apartment. Miss Miles lives in an upstairs apartment at 784 Broadway, which was the scene of the homicide. I went upstairs to Miss Miles' apartment. I spoke with her regarding the incident. She stated that she did know the victim, DeMario Lowe's. She stated that DeMario often hung out outside of her building. She stated that DeMario would drive up in his car and open the trunk and just listen to his music. Miss Miles stated that on this night, DeMario had drove up to the building and was outside for about half an hour listening to music. She said that no one was outside with him. He was by himself. Miles stated that she was in her apartment when she happened to look out of a window and saw a small car drive up in the alley directly behind the building. She said that she saw the car after she looked out of her south window of her apartment. She said that there are plastic over the windows of her apartment, so she didn't get a good look at the car. She described it as being a small and box-shaped. Miles stated that after a couple of more minutes, she heard some arguing below. Miles said that after a few moments, she heard shots. She stated that she heard what appeared to be someone running inside of the front of the building and trying to come up the steps. She said that she heard additional shots. She said that she did not go to the door to see what was going on because she was in fear of her own safety. After a few moments, after the shots ended, she looked out the window and saw what she described as a tall figure running back towards the alley. She said that the figure got into the car that she had supposed was the one that pulled up behind the apartment building and drive off. She was unable to get a good look at the vehicle for any description, however, she describes it as being small and box-shaped. Miles stated after the shooting ended, she later looked outside of her apartment door where she saw DeMario had been shot. Miles said the victim was lying down at the bottom of the steps. Miles described this fleeing figure that she saw running from the side of the apartment as tall and very thin. Miles stated that she did not know who it was, she could only make out that the subject was tall and thin. Miles stated that after the incident had ended, she then called police. End quote. I believe Victoria's call to the police was the call referenced by Takamoto that directed them to 784 Broadway, the one that came in after he had already searched the area of the 7 and 800 block of Ogden, and after another call came in suggesting the shots came from the 700 block of either Pearl or Broadway, which makes some sense, especially when we get into Victoria's more detailed statements in a coming episode. Clearly, some time had elapsed between the attack and her call to 911. For now, let's just take note of the series of events. She first notices a small car drive into the alley behind the building. No time noted for when this occurred. At that point, she says DeMario was in front of the apartment by himself listening to music. Shortly after the car pulled up, she heard arguing in the front of the building. And remember, minutes are going to matter here. The car pulls up, presumably the person in the car then has to walk to the front of the building and then begin arguing with DeMario. The arguing goes on for, quote, a few moments, and then she hears the shots. A few moments later, she looks out of her window and sees who she describes as a tall, thin man running back toward the alley and then get into the car. Now keep in mind that it's pitch black outside. There are no street lights in the alley, and she's looking through plastic. If you've ever lived in a house with drafty windows in the wintertime, then you know exactly what she's talking about. Oftentimes, Viz Queen is stretched over windows like this in the winter in an attempt to keep the heat from escaping or drafts from coming in. Honestly, I'm having a hard time understanding how she could even make out the height and build of the suspect because the type of plastic material used for this purpose is usually pretty opaque. It allows light to pass through it, but that's about it. She will later say that there was a light shining from the house next door that created kind of a silhouette of the man running away. But back by the alley, it would be difficult to see anything at all at night. But then Victoria says that after the shooting ended, quote, she later looked outside of her apartment door where she discovered DeMario's body at the bottom of the steps. Detective Blake McKinney also interviewed Victoria on the night of the murder and noticed the subtle differences in his report. First and foremost, he says that he interviewed Victoria at 12:30 a.m., which is interesting because the crime supposedly occurred at 12:40 a.m. So that's problem number one. Problem number two is that in this version, the order of events is different from McGinnis's interview. In that report, Victoria heard the shots, saw the man run in the alley, waited a bit, then opened the door, saw DeMario, and then after the incident, called 911. But listen to what McKinney wrote in his report from his interview with Miles. Victoria begins by saying that around 11 p.m., DeMario had pulled up to the apartment building, popped his trunk, and began listening to music. Then, quote, approximately 45 minutes later, Victoria Miles stated she observed a smaller vehicle, dark in color, pull into the alley that is located directly behind her apartment. Victoria Miles stated that the driver then parked his vehicle in the alley. Victoria Miles stated the driver then got out of his vehicle and approached DeMario Lowe's. Victoria Miles stated after a short conversation, the unknown subject and DeMario Lowe's got into a verbal argument and began cursing each other. Victoria Miles stated after hearing them argue for approximately 5 minutes, she heard approximately 8 gunshots. Victoria Miles stated she then looked outside to where she heard the gunshots being fired, and she then heard 2 or 3 more gunshots downstairs in the hallway. Victoria Miles stated she then immediately got her cellular phone and dialed 911. Victoria Miles stated as she was dialing 911, she observed the unknown subject get back into his vehicle and drive north on the alley. Victoria Miles stated after dialing 911, she walked downstairs and observed DeMario Lowe's laying on the floor in the hallway, end quote. In this version, Victoria, quote, immediately called 911 on her cell phone when she heard the shots fired in the building, and she saw the man running away while she was on the phone with dispatch. Well, first and foremost, this simply isn't true. It can't be. Remember, Officer Takamoto himself heard the 3 shots. He had already driven to the area where he thought they had come from and searched 2 blocks before even the first 911 call came in. And that caller didn't even know which street the gunfire was coming from. It was only after that call that Victoria then called and advised dispatch of the incident along with the address. So there's just no way that she could have called seconds after the shooting and before the suspect had fled the scene. Another reason why the dispatch log is a critical element of the investigation and is conveniently missing from this case file. It's also another reason why I requested recordings and transcripts of the interviews, so we can hear what Victoria actually said instead of what the detectives say that she said. It should also be noted that this report was written on the 27th of November, 11 days after the murder and well into McGinnis's attempts to build a case against Jody. In an attempt to get a better idea of when the actual murder occurred, let's review the timing provided by Victoria, at least according to Detective McKinney. In the report, it says that Victoria saw DeMario pull up to the building and park his car at around 11 p.m. When he got there, he opened his hatchback and began playing music. About 45 minutes passes by when Miles sees the car pull into the alley and the man approach Lowe's. So that would be around 11:45 p.m. Following this was a, quote, short conversation, and then an argument ensued. The two men argued for approximately 5 minutes, and then came the gunshots. This timeline is incredibly problematic for the state's case against Jody Hill. Jody's timesheet shows that they were signed out of work by their supervisor at 12:05 a.m. And according to Victoria, in this interview, that according to McKinney occurred at 12:30, DeMario's killer arrived on the scene at around 11:45 p.m., a full 20 minutes before Jody even clocked out of work on the other side of town. And now you see why I find it incredibly suspicious that the dispatch log is still missing from the case file. There really is no clear timeline here. We have Victoria saying that DeMario got to the apartment house alone at 11 p.m. and was outside listening to music for 45 minutes before his killer arrived. But remember back to Canvas Smith's statement. She says that DeMario dropped his cousin off, then took her home, and then left saying that he had something to do and he was supposed to return at 1:15 a.m. to pick her back up, but he never showed. And the police got to Canvas because of a statement by a woman named Dora Miles, who said that Canvas was with DeMario 15 minutes before he was killed. Contrast that with Victoria's statement that Lowe's was hanging out by himself at the house for 45 minutes before he was killed, and your guess is as good as mine as to what actually happened in that hour leading up to the murder. But besides the obvious question, what was the thing that DeMario had to go do, there's another very important question that no one ever seems to have bothered to ask back in 2001 when Jody was being charged with this murder. So we know that Jody didn't clock out of work until 12:05 a.m. At the very latest, the murder occurred at 12:40 a.m. I think it actually happened significantly sooner than that, but for the sake of argument, we'll say that it could have been as late as 12:40. That's 35 minutes. You're going to learn in later episodes all the details, but I'll tell you now that Jody didn't have their car at work. They were given a ride home. So that cuts the window of opportunity down even more. But here's the big question. How the hell would Jody have known where to find DeMario? According to the state, this was a premeditated murder connected to the robbery on the 13th. Mario was all over the place that night. He spent time with a few different people and traveled all over town. He didn't live at 784 Broadway. He actually didn't even live in the city of Benton Harbor. He lived on Crystal Avenue in Benton Heights. So someone answered this question for me. If Jody Hill got home from work and then immediately left their house to go kill DeMario Lowe's, how would they possibly know to go to 784 Broadway to find him? Hey gang, the material that we're covering this season is incredibly heavy and can really take a toll on our mental health if we don't make an effort to unplug from time to time. I want to recommend to you to give the podcast True Crime Obsessed a try the next time you're still feeling up for some true crime, but wouldn't mind an approach a little on the lighter side. In each episode, Patrick and Jillian recap a true crime documentary. Their approach and delivery is definitely lighter. They're both really fun and definitely super funny, but they somehow manage to always toe the line between fun and disrespectful. Their episodes are informative as well as entertaining, but most importantly, they always, always maintain the highest level of respect for the victims. True Crime Obsessed is a great place to unwind a bit, have a little fun, and still be a part of advocating for victims of crime. So check out True Crime Obsessed anywhere you get your podcasts. Before I end today's episode, as promised, I want to share with you the context of the emails that I've exchanged with Public Safety Director Dan McGinnis. I think the best way to do that is just to read them to you directly. Our conversation began when I sent McGinnis the following email on April 28th. This was 2 months after filing my FOIA request with his agency. I was still in fact-gathering mode at this point. Quote, Dan, this is Bob Ruff. It's been a minute. I was the chief at North Berrien from 2012 to 2016. I'm writing regarding the work that I do now. For the last 8 years, I've been working as an investigative journalist primarily focused on potential wrongful convictions. I recently had a case brought to me from the city of Benton Harbor. I'm still working on gathering info on the case at this point. In fact, I've had some issues getting case materials from your department. I'm reaching out because I would like to sit down with you to discuss what I'm doing before I move forward with anything public. I would like to officially interview you at some point, if you're willing to, but first I'd just like to have an off-the-record conversation about it. I always like to keep local law enforcement informed on what I'm doing when I take on a case like this. Please let me know if you're willing to have a meeting sometime soon to speak off the record about Joseph's case and my intentions moving forward. End quote. So like I said on the follow-up on Friday, it was not my intention to fight against the police department. My hope was to work with them. McGinnis ignored this email. I never got a response. A little over a week later was when I received the message that the case file had been found, and 3 weeks after that, I received the partial case file. That's when I started sending messages through the information management system requesting the missing materials and asking for an explanation as to why they weren't included. None of those messages were responded to. They were all ignored. So on June 12th, I'd had enough, and I sent the following email to the mayor, the city manager, and I copied McGinnis. Quote, Benton Harbor administrators, I'm writing because I've reached a point of frustration where the only step that I have left is a lawsuit and or official complaint to the Attorney General's office. My name is Bob Ruff. I filed a FOIA request with the Department of Public Safety for the case file from a 2001 murder case. The request was filed on February 12th of this year. Weeks later, I received a response via the online system stating that a past chief was, quote, ignorant of document retention policy and shredded many files, end quote. That was on March 5th. I requested updates on March 7th and March 18th. Both were ignored. Then, 2 months later, on March 7th, I received a message that the file was found. On May 30th, a partial file was sent to me, and this is where my real concern comes in. On May 31st, I informed the person fulfilling the request through the online system that there are several known items missing from the case file. That email was ignored. On June 7th, I stopped by the station and no one was there, so I sent another email. This was also ignored. In that email, I explained that I have spoken with representatives from the prosecutor's office, and they confirmed to me that not only do the missing items exist, but they also confirmed that they returned them to the police department. On Monday of this week, I stopped by the station again and left a note. Sergeant Oakley called me and informed me that Chief McGinnis is the one handling the request. He assured me that he would have Chief call me. Again, I have zero response from McGinnis. In the midst of this now four-month process, I also emailed Chief McGinnis directly. I informed him of my intention to produce an international podcast series on the case that I filed the FOIA about. I also requested an informal meeting to discuss my intentions and made sure he was aware of the ongoing FOIA delays. I did not even get the courtesy of a response from the chief. It was never my intention to go over the chief's head on this, but now I'm hoping that his superiors, someone within the Benton Harbor City government, can assist on a resolution here. The situation at this point is becoming suspicious at best. The case in question is a potential wrongful conviction case that includes allegations of corruption by the lead detective on the case. That lead detective is Daniel McGinnis. And now McGinnis sits in the position of chief and is controlling the production of the public records, on top of that refuses to even reply to a single email or phone call to try to explain the situation. All I am asking for here is transparency and a basic level of professionalism. I believe city officials should be closely considering whether a conflict of interest exists in a police chief handling a FOIA request for a case where he has been accused of misconduct. I'll be looking forward to your response and hopefully a quick resolution to these concerns. End quote. My hope in sending this email was that McGinnis's supervisors would demand at the very least that he respond to me, and hopefully assign someone else to handle the FOIA request. Instead, 2 weeks went by with no response. Then, Thursday evening of last week, I finally received this from McGinnis. Quote, Mr. Ruff, I will address your concerns categorically. 1. Copy of the original case file was indeed shredded by past chief. The original murder book was displaced from the DB at some point. That is a fact I could not have helped. 2. I acknowledge the fact that you did email me directly and asked to meet regarding this case. Although you are not a person I would care to meet with, nor do I care anything about your podcast, I should have contacted you back. To that, I concede that I was in error. 3. Additional circumstances that contributed to the delay was that we had a pipe burst in our basement and water crept into the evidence room. We spent several days ensuring there was no damage to current or historical evidence. This was a long and painstaking process. Again, to the point number 2 above, I should have communicated that to you. 4. Regarding the missing files, you received a complete copy of the original murder book. I am not sure what you are claiming you can prove is missing. And you insinuation that there is some nefarious conspiracy to hide information well quite frankly speaks to the fact why I have no interest in having any conversation with you at all. 5. Again, your 10,000 subscriber podcast has zero interest or influence on me, and that doesn't change the facts above. 6. As far as your scurrilous attack on my integrity as the investigator in this case, this is where you look the most foolish. This, quote, corrupt lead investigator, as you framed it, has personally reached out to the Case Integrity Unit of Attorney General's Office to ask them to take up this case. I just recently received notice that they have indeed moved this application to the front of the pile and have accepted the case. I have spoken to the new lead investigator who will be coming to look at the case file and evidence. This also contributed to the delay. So you must admit that if I asked for the case to be looked at and scrutinized, it would be non sequitur to assume I corruptly had something to hide. 7. I suppose your threat of lawsuit and or to contact the Attorney General's office to file a complaint is moot. The AG's office has reopened the case. All current case files and the case evidence is now open again and is exempt from FOIA until the conclusion of the investigation. Nothing else will be released. Any other FOIA requests on this case are denied. If you have any other communications on this, you should go directly through the city attorney, Sarah Seneca. She's included in this email. Best regards, Director McGinnis. End quote. Now, there's a whole lot going on here. In fact, I haven't contacted the city's attorney yet because I have lawyers reviewing this mess to advise me of next steps. But this is what I understand up to this point. I'll address Mr. McGinnis's concerns categorically. First of all, the city legally had 15 days maximum to respond to my FOIA request. If everything McGinnis is saying here is true, he's now trying to deny the request that was due months ago by, quote, reopening the case now. It's not how this works. The case was open when I filed the request, and still open when the request was due. Now, McGinnis never says when he sent the case file to the Attorney General's office, but I can tell you when he didn't send it. Before he found it. According to my communications with him, there was no case file until May 7th, when he says that it was finally found. So I don't think he can make the argument that he sent the file to the AG's office for review before he found the file. And secondly, I'm curious what he means when he says the case is open. There is a conviction on the books, and no current appeals in the courts. I don't think that the CIU reviewing the case deems it open, certainly not for the purposes of a FOIA exemption. Reviewed is not the same as open. Thirdly, the idea that I'm supposed to feel foolish for thinking this, quote, corrupt lead investigator, his words, not mine, by the way, lacks integrity because he asked the AG's office to scrutinize the case is kind of the biggest joke in all of this. Because, like, what are they reviewing? He's claiming that he gave me the entire case file, everything they have, which means he's having the CIU review what? His reports? That file doesn't have anything in it. There's not a single crime scene photo, no witness interviews or recordings, no key witness interview transcriptions, no dispatch logs. There are DNA testing results missing from it. The hell are they reviewing? But the good news is that, assuming McGinnis is being honest here, we're 1 week into this season, and the state's Attorney General's Office Conviction Integrity Unit is already on the case, which is pretty amazing. Literally, just the threat of a podcast was enough to get them involved. And thankfully, even though Director McGinnis doesn't have anything interesting in his case file for them to review, I have lots of really interesting evidence that I will be turning over to them. So for that, Director McGinnis, I do sincerely thank you. And not for nothing, but in response to your remark about my little 10,000 subscriber podcast, Dan, you're confused. You're looking at our YouTube channel. That's not the podcast. That's just for fun. Between my audience and the help of some friends in the business, the first episode of this series has already been listened to by well over 1 million people and counting. So hopefully you're proud of the job that you're doing because the world is now listening. All sarcasm aside, I genuinely hope that McGinnis is sincere when he says that he wants the case scrutinized. And I certainly hope that it would be his desire to have this conviction overturned once we prove that Jody Hill is innocent. Like I've been saying, it is not my desire to fight against the Benton Harbor Police Department. My hope instead is to work with them. And I am 100% willing to do that with Director McGinnis or his replacement. Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music for Season 15 is created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weber. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X at Truth Justice Pod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney, and Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.